All those times I drove to town carefully over packed snow. Is this what it comes to? Yes, it is, my dear mother. The tablecloths you saved are all gone. The baked corn dish you made for your boys. The Christmas Eve's opening gifts of perfume from your husband. It is all gone. The nurses take my father for his bath. What sort of flowers are those? Daisies, I say. A few minutes later, you ask again. You and I wait here for Jacob to come back from his bath. What can I do? The nurses take my father for his bath. What sort of flowers are those? Daisies, I say. A few minutes later, you ask again. You and I wait here for Jacob to come back from his bath. What can I do but feel time go through me and wait with you? So I think we have about 15 minutes, a little more. Does anyone want to say anything to me? Yes. We can choose one time to walk with him shoulder to shoulder, and then another time you visit him when he's alone and tell him off. Don't do it at the same time. I know, both of them are hard, because we want something. And in neither case are you going to get anything. He isn't going to accept your points when you tell him off. But when you really told him off and told him what you think about him and the way he's treated you, you don't have to bring up your mother too much. But a little bit of that's okay, too. And the house or whatever, he'll deny everything. And then later he'll say, my God, that kid's grown up a little. Feel a little pride for you. He won't admit it, of course. But still, it's an important moment. And then being able to walk with your father without judgment is a wonderful thing, too. As you know, we're all complicated. We deserve to be judged and not judged. Mainly, I think the trouble is that we want something from our father and our mother, whatever, whichever one is the one that's been holding back. Whichever one has been holding back, we want something. And I was with the men out in California, and I said, you see, what happens is, I'm 59 years old, I walk into the room where my father is, by the time I sit down, I'm 14. There's only four steps. And so I think that Alice Miller is very helpful here when she says, you needed something early in your life that you did not receive, and you are not going to get it. If you don't understand that, you're going to waste a lot of time in that blaming and that longing. You are not going to get it. The proper attitude is mourning. And then, of course, you realize how messed up we all are. I want to leave this now and go on to something else. But there's another sentence of Alice Miller's that I remember so well from her book, Gifts. It's called The Drama of the Gifted Child, or Prisons of Childhood. It had two names, hardcover and soft. By the way, you might like to know what she thinks of people like the transpersonal psychologists. I went over to their convention, and as you know, they're great ascenders. And we were at Basel. I said, we're already at 10,000 feet, and you want to go still higher? Anyway, I like the transpersonal. I like the way they're trying to say, we don't want to get stuck in Freud. But that isn't what happens. They just talk about light all the time and higher consciousness. Higher consciousness is related to upward mobility. They don't seem to notice that. And they say we're interested in enlightenment, and I say you have the wrong person. I'm interested in enlightenment. So they had three of us talking there who were interested in enlightenment. One was a doctor from South Africa, and the other one was this wonderful man named Harry Wilmer, who talked about the dreams of Vietnam veterans. And I was the other one, and Rita Louise von Fontz was another. She talked about the hairy man or the wild man. And then the rest of them were Boeing 707, heading for the spirit. So, actually, Alice Miller had sent me a note because I had praised her books in the United States, and I wrote a blurb for one of them, and so she was there, and so my wife and I had met her, and she said, don't tell anybody I am here, because she's very introverted, and she doesn't like anything. So I said, you know, she said, let's go and have dinner. So we went to have lunch, and so I said, what do you think of this thing here? She said, it makes me very angry. She says, I'll tell you what I think. She said, you see, each one of us had a separate and particular childhood, with its own particular grief and its own particular sorrow. You know what these people do? They throw away all the particularities of the childhood, and they're left with a sorrowful child and a joyful child. And then they throw away the sorrowful child. And then, what, is that clear what she said? They have one vaporized, joyful child is only God. She said, it makes me very angry. That's a strong woman. She says what she thinks, huh? Isn't that good? Isn't that so, Rosemary? It's a particularity and the particular griefs that are at issue, not whether we all have the capacity for spiritual life and all that. That isn't quite the point. That's a given. Yes, please. Yes. And she's the only one. Well, I'll tell you in her book, Thou Shalt Not Be Aware, right? It comes to that sentence that I want to say. Thank you for that. Here's the other sentence from her book. Every act of cruelty, conscious or unconscious, that our parents take, the child interprets to be an act of love. She said, in this sentence, the suffering of the human race is hidden. Every act of cruelty, conscious or unconscious, that the parents take, the child considers to be an act of love. Because you're so small, if you oppose your parents at early acts of cruelty, they simply leave you and you'll die. All of us have been abandoned many times in previous lives. We know what that's like, to die, to be abandoned by our parents and die. So it's an instinct early on. You cannot stand up for yourself or you'll die. And so, therefore, unable to move in any other way, when our parents take an act of cruelty, we have no choice. We interpret it to be an act of love. Is that clear? And then later in love, later in your life, when that thing is not untangled, every act of love that you have will have some cruelty in it. And every time a person is cruel to you, you'll imagine there's some love in it. Is this a prospect? Is this a formula for a messed up life or not? That's a wonderful sentence. Every act of cruelty, conscious or unconscious, even the unconscious, even the conscious ones. I know my wife works with children who are abused, and it's incredible how they take the blame for everything. Oh, yes, I was wrong that day. I shouldn't have been lying on the couch like that. One girl said to her, I should have had my bedroom door locked. And she said, it was your own house.
Why should you have had your bedroom door locked?
So, thou shalt not be aware is the order. You shall not be aware of any cruelties that happened to you as a child. You shall not be aware. And so when we saw her that day, she said, I am so amazed. I am so amazed at the Americans. She said, you know, I'm the only person in Germany that is really talking in this way about the child abuse. And in America, I can't believe it how fast she was gone. She knew all the names of the books, like Kiss Daddy Goodbye, all those books in English. She said, I can't believe it how you're moving in America. So I was so amazed. Yep. How deep is what? Are you kidding? Are you kidding? Are you kidding? What is this, a cynical animal we got here? Read them and find out. I was in a depression 3 weeks after reading her first book, Prisons of Childhood. It was a good depression, too. Who cares? Do it yourself. Forget about society. The issue is not whether society hears, whether it's you here. All right. What I'd like to do is to... Would anyone have any questions they'd like to ask me now about things that really haven't been taken up? Yes, please. Yes. No, I don't come to any framework. Ask me in 20 years. What I give, I give. You have to do the work yourself in putting it into a framework. Yes. I think it's I think so too. It's meant to be a little shocking statement to put you into this. Like, it's a tricky statement, but it's meant to put you in exactly where you are. Oh, certainly. And the implication, if you think it over, is that this has happened to us many times. And every time it happened, we said, oh, God, and I did it, and I did it. Well, he did it, he did it, she did it, she did it, she did it. And at a certain moment, the fairy tales leave out all of that. And it has come to the moment when the change took place. The question was, this statement, it's through no fault of my own that I lost it. She feels a little suspicious of that because, of course, it's important to take the responsibility. So I were just saying that he probably had taken responsibility in a wrong way many times. Yes, please. Yes, I think it's a little off the subject, but maybe in relation to shame. So the question is about the hag. You see, when you're talking about beings in the other world, you have the witch, you have the giant, you have the false innkeeper. All these are beings in the other world. They descend into our world temporarily and then go back again. Now, the hag is not one of those. In the Middle Ages, the hag, H-A-G, is not a witch. She does not have occult powers. That's not it. The hag was done physically in the Middle Ages as an ugly woman to indicate to women that there are several times in their life in which they may need to be a hag. It happens in the presence of passive men, a woman will often become a hag. And this is a natural thing that happens to her. And it usually frightens the passive male because he's still obsessed with beauty. inner and outer. But that happens. Another time a woman needs to become a hag is when she has been nurturing all her life, and that ends, and she has to get a job and do something like that. Has to move out of the nurturing, and she'll feel ugly inside because she's not nurturing. And the Middle Ages helped her, saying, this is what you really feel like inside is this hag. Kundry and Dame Ragnall and so on. So the woman has to see that this ugliness she feels inside is not a bad thing at all. I don't know. The question is, in talking of grandfathers, do you distinguish between your father's father or your mother's father? I just finished a book on Thoreau called The Poetic Voice of Thoreau. I took things from his journals and mixed them with his poems. Sierra Club is just printed. And of course, without anyone who throws life a lot. Now, let's throw this out because we must go on. I want to give you a couple of poems before we end. In Thoreau's case, his father had not been to college. His mother's father had been to Harvard. His mother used her father as an image for Thoreau to model himself on as a male. She did not use her own husband. A characteristic of women, which Erik Erikson mentions, is that when they're looking for a male model, they will often go to their own father and impose it on their son. In this case, Thoreau didn't want to go to college. But she had picked him as a favorite son, and he was the one who was going to go, because her father went. He was bored all the way through Harvard. And it's a very funny deal. On the day he graduated, the graduation time, Emerson gave the American Scholar as a commencement address. Thoreau walked home. He didn't even hear it. He walked home to Concord. And when he got home, there was this incredible scene, and he said to his mother had always been his mother's favorite, and all of that, and he said, what shall I do now? I mean, he'd done what she asked. He'd gone through Harvard. And he said, what shall I do now? What shall we do now? His mother said, oh, you could put on your knapsack and walk around the world. Tears leaped in his eyes. He was shocked. He never understood what it meant. His mother really wasn't loving him. She was loving his father. Tears came in his eyes. His sister was there. She reported it. She said, I put my arms on him and said, no, Henry, no, you'll stay here with us. And that's what he did. He lived in that house until he died. You see that thing? Therefore, we have to realize that the male line is often clearer in that way. Because on a father's side, there's often determination, animus stuff, as a Jungian scholar, and all of that. I'm just throwing that out to you to disturb you. Be careful, if you're a woman, that you are not using your father, as a model for your son. Son needs to choose his own models. You're messing up again. In many cases, the males are too passive and the women are too active in this area of the sun. All right. Yes, please. I got one of those. I said, I don't know, it was a strange question. He said, the other day you asked someone to write down some thoughts because I couldn't deal with it at the moment. She said, did you get those? I got them from one. Barbara, have you done yours yet? Where's Barbara? Oh, there she is. She's writing it right now, marvelously. She had the most marvelous idea. And tell us what you said about the sword. Would you say that again?
I said that I wondered if women had not become impatient with the change in the culture, and historically it's the young son who always overthrows the old king, and that's what issues in the new culture, and the women have waited for that. And I'm wondering if in our generation the women have stopped waiting and have taken the sword that belongs to our sons and are using our sons' swords to bludgeon their fathers.
That's called a new idea. Now, we want to keep on schedule here as much as we can. I'd like to do one poem to close with. Would that feel all right for you? I want to mention in Iron John, for example, when you're thinking through that story, remember the battle section. The battle section where he gets the horse from underground and does the battle. That's also a part of the young male stopping being passive and naive, to agree to do hard battle inside himself. And also outside if necessary. I don't mean in war. The tradition is that if you do not teach a male to battle inside, he'll battle outside. So when the male can be taught to battle inside, the desire to kill others is not dominant or to battle others. And so there's that quality of the naive male in which in some way, I remember, I don't want to tell a story, we've got to go. This is a poem from Loving a Woman in Two Worlds. We'll close with this poem. I wrote it when we were on the way to a meditation retreat in Kansas, I think it was, in an airplane. It's called A Third Body. The Third Body. A man and a woman sit near each other. And they do not long at this moment to be older or younger or born in any other nation or any other time or any other place. They are content to be where they are, talking or not talking. Their breath together feeds someone whom we do not know. The man sees the way his fingers move. He sees her hands close over a book that she hands to him. They obey a third body that they share in common. They have made a promise to love that body. Age may come, parting may come, death will come. A man and a woman sit near each other, and as they breathe, they feed someone we do not know, someone we know of, but have never seen.